From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always good to have somebody who works in real-life mythology. And my guest, writer-director John Lee Hancock, is no stranger to that, doing films such as, well, The Blind Side and The Rookie. And his new film as director and writer is basically kind of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead with the Texas Rangers. It's The Highwaymen. Do you say that's an apt kind of take on it, John?
I think so. I see. I think I get the humor, and I halfway agree. I think we all love, or at least I do, Penn's 1967 movie. So this is just the other side of the story, kind of flipping the lens to a different part of the story.
And characters who are just as mythic as Bonnie and Clyde were. Mm-hmm. And again, you seem to be attracted to this kind of mythology of real-life people, the founder, and people who are bigger than life. But also, there's a schism in your films I always find to be really interesting, which is people who are rooted in the past, who can't see the future, and people who can see the future. That's a kind of a dynamic you like to explore, isn't it?
It is. I'm with regard to this movie in particular, I've always been a huge fan of Lonely Are the Brave.
Sure. And I'm, which is very much that kind of movie, isn't it?
It is. I mean, and A Perfect World was kind of in that realm as well.
But so is The Rookie.
Yes.
And so is Blind Side. And so is The Founder. I mean, yeah. The guys who can't see the future are the McDonald brothers.
Yes.
And it's Ray Kroc who can see the future.
Yes.
And here it's, I guess it's Ma Ferguson who sees the future. And Frank and Galt can't see the future. Really.
Right. I'm taken with characters who were born 100 years too late, you know, that idea.
And that's also, having spent time in Texas, a very Texas thing, people who just see what's in front of them, because you can live a life that's kind of isolated from the present in Texas in a lot of ways, can't you?
Absolutely. Texas is a bit of an enigma.
But I want to get back to talking about this dynamic that you find so interesting to dramatize. I wonder where that comes from for you.
I don't know. It's just really, you know, in search of good stories that you know you're willing to spend 2 years on and wake up at 4:30 in the morning to tell. And I'm not a real fan of waking up that early, but you know, when you have something, you go, no, I can dedicate myself to this and still be interested in it.
Because it's also, these movies are also kind of a look at guys hanging on to an ideal of masculinity that's kind of dying in front of them too, isn't it? They're just very much Lonely Are the Brave.
No doubt. No doubt.
Because I just wonder if that's the Texas you grew up in and those are the kinds of guys you were around, or?
I think that's partially true. I think that when Kennedy was assassinated, I think I was in first grade maybe.
Wow.
And so talk about a humbling thing for a very proud state. Texas was brought to its knees and forced to look at itself a bit. And it wasn't always pretty. So I think that there's been some self-reflection ever since the Kennedy assassination.
But also there's a kind of swagger that you're attracted to bringing to the screen, isn't there?
I knew of Frank Hamer and the legendary Frank Hamer and the Texas Rangers. And they are mythic and they're bigger than life. And even the way they walk and talk when you meet them today, it's as though they've come through a special refining academy or something to be different kind of cops.
I was really struck, too, by the shoes these guys wear. I mean, mm-hmm. These are, everybody else is kind of wearing new shoes, and these guys are wearing the shoes they've had forever.
Yeah.
I mean, just to talk about, because this is also your second real take with the Rangers, because A Perfect World is about a Texas Ranger, mm-hmm. and this guy who's kind of out of time, and basically bringing this out of time. One of my favorite sequences is that when they just sort of stop to grill steaks mm-hmm. in the middle of the movie, which feels like a very sort of arrogant, this is my world kind of thing to do.
Right. Right. Yeah. I guess you could say it's the slowest chase movie of all time.
But and like this movie, it's not really about the chase.
It's not.
It's about the way these guys are dealing with the world changing around them. And was that your first take on it? Or
it was, to me, it was very much about an emotional journey that these two men, who have a terrible gift, they're very good at hunting and killing people. And they know what the road holds for them. And they know what's at the end of it. And it's going to be bloody and it's going to be grotesque. And there's no joy in it. It's just something that has to be done. And I was this, you know, you could be Bonnie and Clyde, it could be anybody, but I just was interested in Frank and Mamie and this journey and the toll it takes on them.
I think, too, because we can see the toll it's taken on them heretofore. I mean, that great sequence where we meet Manny, it's almost shot like it's a Dorothea Lange or WPA photographs. I mean, it's really beautiful stuff. And delineating what life was like in Texas and during that period, basically living in the midst of the Depression, where the idea of these outlaws who were stealing from people who were stealing from others made sense to mythologize these people.
I think Bonnie and Clyde were ready-made for that for a couple of reasons. One, like you said, banks were foreclosing on farms and houses, and they were robbing banks, so they were given a pass. I mean, despite the fact that they killed not only a lot of cops, but some innocent citizens. But also, I think the fact that, I mean, because this was, there were a lot of, I mean, with Pretty Boy Floyd and Dillinger, and this was the era of these gangsters. I think that the fact that there was a woman involved, you know, made them kind of almost star-crossed lovers and caught the imagination of people. And I also think that when the photographs from Joplin, Missouri were published and people could see them and see how stylish they were, and they were hugging and they were doing it, just they were above the fold on every newspaper in America. And so in some ways it's an examination of the cult of popularity and branding. I mean, they were aware of branding before branding was branding.
In effect, Bonnie was the first Twitter star, wasn't she?
She would be alive and well on Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat today.
But I was thinking, too, because there's you and there's Robert Benton, you know, these Texans who are interested in the idea of myth and media. Mm-hmm. And the idea of myth and media and then the way this stuff is covered also plays a part in the way you've worked as well, in The Rookie and Blindside, the fact that these people are living one life and the media has this, a whole other take on it. I mean, people observing what's going on around them is really key to the way you think about these things in dramatic terms too, isn't it?
It is. And it's also what makes it, I think, a contemporary movie. I thought that the issues and the themes were something that, you know, are alive and well today.
Is that one of the things you wanted to do with it, to make the point that this stuff really hasn't, in a lot of ways, gone away?
I think that's one of the points to make. I mean, I was first and foremost just interested in the dark journey of these two guys. But the kind of cult of celebrity, you know, is certainly alive and well today. And I was taken, when I read John Fusco's script and did more research, I was really taken by the idea that Bonnie and Clyde had fans. I mean, real fans, real followers. And everybody in Texas has a story about, you know, their small town and their grandfather, great-grandfather met Bonnie and Clyde when they stopped to eat at this cafe. And people back then had autograph books. And they would get, you know, autographs. It was crazy.
What was your thought, though? I mean, looking at this material about Manny and Frank, I mean, what did you think about these guys as characters?
I liked the fact that it was a two-hander for the following reason. You got to expose kind of two sides of the same coin. I think you've got one in Frank Hamer, a very stoic man who doesn't talk a lot, who would make you think or have you believe that none of this really bothers him. He doesn't lose any sleep over hunting down and killing bad guys. And then you've got, you know, almost his conscience, if you will, in Manny Gault. It's someone who wears it on his sleeve, talks about it incessantly,
self-medicates,
doesn't sleep, has nightmares, is terrified of having to draw a gun on a girl, and talks about it all the time. And what we come to find out in the movie is that even though it appears that Frank doesn't really ponder those things, it sits with him deeply.
Because you almost wonder, in seeing the movie, if Frank hadn't been retired, if he would have retired anyway, just because of the toll it was taking on him. That's one of the kind of questions you kind of leave hanging in the air in the film, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that Frank probably didn't need the job. He had a private security firm that he had founded for oil field stuff and was doing just fine. He had married well. He had a beautiful house there on Riverside Drive in Austin, right across from downtown. Manny was not doing as well. But, you know, I think when Ma Ferguson became governor, all the Rangers had hated Ma Ferguson so much that they either quit or she shoved them aside.
We should say, too, that she was famous for how many people did she furlough from prison? Like almost 5,000 people?
You could write a check.
Yeah.
Yes, and get out. Which was part of what the Rangers didn't like about her.
I mean, there's so much great subtext, too, because she came in following her husband, who had been the most corrupt governor in Texas history.
Paul Ferguson. Yes.
Yes. And was equally corrupt herself in her way.
Yeah. She took over for Paul when he was embezzling money or something. And then there was another governor between, and then the next time she ran on her own. And I think Paul was always liked to think of himself as the shadow behind her, really pulling the strings. And
didn't she basically say that he was really the governor?
It was a twofer at the start. It was you know, kind of like, well, you get two for the price of one. I think when she ran again, though, I think Paul was like, yeah, we're back in business. And she goes, no, I got it this time.
We're talking about Texas myth with a man who's brought a lot of them to the big screen, the writer-director John Lee Hancock, whose new film is The Highwaymen. Talk about that title, though, because when you hear Highwaymen, you think about bad guys.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good title for that, because on the one hand, it does kind of refer to the nascent highway patrol in Texas at the time. But when we think of highwaymen, we think of people that are robbing, you know, out on the roads. And I think there's a good question about, you know, exactly, I don't know, are Frank and Mamie the good guys or the bad guys? I mean, it's a horrible, like I said, they have a horrible gift. And it's, hopefully it's a fascinating journey, but I think it's a dark and lonely one too.
I don't know, this idea, maybe for me, having spent a bit of time in Texas, that masculinity is so important to the way people lead their lives there, and mm-hmm. doing things with your hands and being self-reliant, mm-hmm. and not holding to an institution. I mean, so many of these people that you've written about are people who have no patience for institutional thinking.
It's very true. It's very true. I think maybe it is growing up in Texas and having people that you look up to and admire be kind of that strong, masculine, stoic type guy. Maybe that's somehow, you know, my father was a little bit of that.
Was he?
Yeah. I mean, just, he was a public school teacher, but he was very, I mean, you know, he was a Marine. He played in the NFL.
Wow.
He was a football coach and just, you know, a great dad and a lovely man, but just that here's how a man acts kind of ideal. And I think that's very true to Texas and kind of still is.
Did you get that perspective, you think, more after you left Texas? Did it kind of crystallize for you a little bit after you moved here and started to write?
It's a good question. I think it was probably always there to an extent, but I think when you sometimes you have to leave a place to really see a place. And that started when I packed my car up in Houston, Texas to drive to Los Angeles and realized that the halfway point was still Texas. El Paso is the halfway point between Houston and Los Angeles. So it's a big, big state with many geographic regions and lots of different accents and attitudes. And I think being away from it gave me an appreciation for that. And like I said, it's a bit of an enigma.
But it's also, too, there's something about, and even weirdly appends a little bit to the founder, about how people lead much slower lives, you know. And that's the interesting sort of contradiction, too, between the news happening so fast in the highwaymen, but these guys being very deliberate about the way they're going to be, mm-hmm. and not letting the velocity of the modern world kind of affect them at all. Mm-hmm.
Because the velocity of the modern world had failed thus far to capture Bonnie and Clyde. J. Edgar Hoover had been hunting them for 2 years with, you know, the new technology, and that wasn't cutting it. And Frank Hamer said, no, you go old school on them. You get the map out. You figure out how many gas stations and how many roads. They've been sighted here. Now let's draw a circle. There's 9 gallons of gas in a 34 Ford. How far can they go going 75 miles an hour? Where's the next place they're going to have to gas up? And then you guess and move, and you keep moving in big circles.
I mean, that's really kind of the way the rangers work, which is always you basically always tracking somebody on horse.
Yeah.
So you're trying to figure out if you draw a circle where they're going to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're reading a trail either way.
No, that's exactly it. And then to that extent, when you brought up Lonely Are the Brave, I thought, well, that's it, because it's really a modern day Western, mm-hmm. And with these guys, they might as well be on horses, mightn't they?
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. I think even with, I like the idea of modern day Westerns, and sometimes people try to categorize, well, it's a Western. I go, well, it's actually 1934, and they're driving a car, so it's not. But I like the fact that these were men born 100 years too late, and it feels kind of like in the mythology of a Western. And I think The Rookie, when I did The Rookie, and I went in and pitched myself to direct it, and I was asked, what sports movies do you think this is like? Or, you know, what sports movies do you admire, and how would you like to make this sports movie? And I said, I don't look at it as a sports movie. I said, if John Ford were directing a baseball movie, that's the movie I want to do.
Perfect way to describe it. We'll take a break. My guest, who, again, is aware of mythology, wherever it rears its head, is John Lee Hancock. His newest film as writer-director on Netflix is The Highwaymen. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Tribune. We're picking apart Texas with my guest, John Lee Hancock, whose new film on Netflix as writer-director is The Highwayman. I want to talk, too, about the look, because your movies all look very different to me. And clearly you studied a lot of photographs of the era for this, because there's a real kind of sunblasted look that I think we see in a lot of your films anyway, the kind of the toll that the sun takes on everybody in your films. But it seems to be really specific here, isn't it?
It is. And I think that you know, John Schwartzman has shot almost all my movies, and we have conversations about what are we going to embrace in a naturalistic way. With The Rookie, it was, and with this one, we embrace the hot sun midday. I mean, other directors might go, no, I like the softer light at the end of the day in the morning and go inside in the middle of the day. But I think I like it when it's just blasting down and they've got a hat on so you can see their eyes and everything. But I think it's just the heat. Yeah, I like it. I mean, also in this one was kind of a fun enterprise because I wanted the movie to be very naturalistic with Frank and Mamie, but heavily stylized with Bonnie and Clyde. And I almost wanted it. I told John, I said, I want to shoot it like it's a graphic novel. We never get a look at their faces. Because what I'm trying to do is with the viewer, we're trying to build up the notion that they are bigger than life and they are sexy as Warren and Faye. And, you know, I can't wait to see them. And so when you do see them and they emerge into the naturalistic ambush, which they enter Frank and Mamie's world, you see their kids and they're scrawny, and it ain't Warren and Faye.
But also, too, when they're introduced, you introduce color into this. I mean, suddenly it becomes a big, bright, popping movie. And we also get to see all their fans who are dressed up and bring all these colors into that world. And it's interesting, too, because it's this kind of bisection where for Frank and Mamie, the world is black and white.
Yeah. On purpose, yes. I mean, we had many discussions about this. I said I want it to be like a graphic novel, and I want it to be romanticized because I think that in some ways Bonnie and Clyde were romanticized. You know, realistically they were, but I think also because we have Arthur Penn's movie and it's Bonnie and Clyde, and you know there are rap songs about Bonnie and Clyde, and they've entered our consciousness, you know, for generations. And I said, let's lean into that. Let's make those colors pop. Let's make it stylized and then make, like you said, everything for Frank and Mamie is more down the middle, black and white.
But I thought it was interesting, too. I want to talk about the way the movie starts because you basically take a while, and you do this a lot. You take a while to give your protagonists an entrance. You build the world, and then we get to see them apart from that world, which is a way of sort of maintaining that kind of mythologizing of these characters almost.
Yeah, I am kind of fond of that. And I almost always get some pushback initially. It's like, wait a minute, you know, we don't see Sandy Bullock until page 11 in the script. That's, we're paying her a lot of money. Come on.
Does that happen to you a lot? Because people that want us, they figure, we're paying for this, put it on the plate right in front of people.
Yeah, but I like to set the table before you eat.
That's very courtly and southern and old world of you. But it also builds this kind of interesting anticipation for people too, doesn't it?
I hope so. Like Lonely Are the Brave, I mean, it's the shot of Kevin, the first time you see him, he's out by the river, and he's there, and this could be just any cowboy by the river. And then when you come into his face and see it, we see the Congress Avenue Bridge in the background, and we hear cars honking. And the disdainful look on his face tells us that he hates the modern world. And it was just my little nod to Lonely Are the Brave with this first shot of Kirk Douglas by the fire. And you go, it's a cowboy out by his campfire. And then a jet stream goes overhead and he looks up and you realize he was born 100 years too late.
What was your first conversation with these guys, with Costner and Woody Harrelson about the film? What did you say to them?
I think Kevin had read it a while back. It almost came together. I mean, I've been on the movie 13 years.
13 years?
Yeah, and Casey Silver and John Fusco, 15 years. So every time I would go off and make a movie, I would tell Casey, if you find somebody that you want to direct the movie and it's its chance to get made, you have my blessing. I want to make it, but I'm going to go off and do The Blind Side, The Founder, Saving Mr. Banks. And every time I would come back, I would, you know, re-engage with it. And every time I was also a little worried. Sometimes when you're on a project, you move past it. It can still be a great script, but you go, I don't need to tell this story anymore for one reason or another. I'm not sure that I can be engaged for 2 years with it now. But every time I read it, I felt very strongly about it again. And so when we re-engaged with Kevin and sent it to him to read, he got it. And I thought, man, this is a pitch that Kevin can hit. He can drive this ball. I mean, this is a character that he was kind of born to play. And I think he felt when he read it 10 years ago that he wasn't old enough yet. Uh-huh. And I think he was right. So it all came when it happened. I mean, Woody's been attached for 6 years.
Wow.
And Woody said, just call me when you're ready. I'll do it. I'm in. And so I think they aged appropriately. And I think it's the best possible cast.
Yeah, that idea of, and we talked about this a little bit, the idea of these characters being able, by just their own chemistry, by their own size, by their own kind of psychic weight, to slow the world down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. There's no doubt that when you even look at pictures of Frank Hamer, you vibe that the world comes to him. He's, you know, that he's going to do things at his pace, and he's deliberate, and he's not quick to do anything. He's a thoughtful person. I mean, and also just, you know, his history, you could make 10 movies about Frank Hamer. I mean, the lynchings that he stopped by himself, coming into a town in East Texas and saying, this will not happen, and standing at the door of the courthouse, you know, those kinds of things. So he was a man of principle, and I think he had kind of a righteous, righteousness about him, about things that galled him, and that was right and wrong. And I think it probably could be pretty difficult to live in a Frank Hamer world with Frank, because everything was so, as you put it, black and white.
It's a dream. We're talking tonality with the director of The Highwaymen, the writer-director, John Lee Hancock. The film is on Netflix and getting a few theatrical plays. And I was telling you, I'm glad it's getting some theatrical play because it needs to be seen on the big screen. I mean, there is an expanse. And also something you get when you see a movie in the screen of the theater, which is you really get a sense of time being controlled by the filmmaker in a way we don't on the big screen. And so many of these movies that you've made have been about the world being kind of antic and things happening too fast for the first 10 minutes or so until your protagonists enter. Mm-hmm. And the big screen gives us a chance to really experience that speed and then that slowing down, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And hopefully it creates more of a dreamscape than watching on even a big monitor at home. You know, you're in the midst of this. And I do like things that kind of move slowly. I mean, it's one of those things, almost every movie of mine, it's like you go to a preview or a test and it's like, yeah, that was a little slow. But it's usually people under the age of 30, so they want everything to happen in 10 minutes.
It's funny, too, because I also think about it being like a reaction to the way these stories are told, be it The Blind Side or The Highwaymen or The Rookie, the way that these stories are covered by media where they pound so much incident in it. And the point, it almost gets to be kind of this meaningless detail because we don't get a chance to get a sense of the people, the way people inhabit these worlds. You want to say, well, that detail is kind of meaningless. Let's just look at the way people live in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, trying to be as naturalistic to the period, if it's a period movie, as possible, too. But yeah, it just did. I don't know. To me, I'm always looking for what's the perfectly quiet moment, because I think that can have great power in a world where there's so much noise. You know, there's literal noise and there's political noise and there's media noise and we're overcome with noise. And so if you invest in a character and you can find a quiet moment for them, then that has, I think, great power. And it was always my intention that the end of this movie would be very few spoken words. I mean, from the ambush, you know, and how violent and over the top it is, to the grotesque, you know, exhibition that happened in Arcadia, Louisiana, which was even more grotesque than we showed in the movie.
Really?
Yeah, people trying to cut off Clyde's trigger finger. You know, it was the craziness. Craziness. And it's so grotesque that it's just the worst of humanity. And so I think in the movie, when they talk about, you know, how it's going to end, it's going to be bloody. And those sound like kind of movie lines because we've heard them before. In this case, it's really true. It's awful and it's bloody and there is no joy in Mudville. And at the end of it, I said, I want everybody to feel sorry for everybody. This is just a lonely business and it's awful. And then to see the worst of humanity, they loved Bonnie and Clyde when they were alive and they love them when they're dead. And that there would be very few words spoken. I mean, I think Kevin's last line is stick 'em up, And Woody's is Shame on You.
Wow, because I also want to talk, too, about the way you use sound in the movie. I mean, because the sound is also a way to sort of, and we touched on it a little bit here, to delineate the difference between the old world and the modern world. I mean, thinking about all that noise in the very first 5 or 6 minutes of the movie, I mean, and the sound bouncing around everywhere. It's almost like the world is so noisy, you need to go to people who lead quieter lives, who have the kind of concentration and can shut the world out in a lot of ways.
No, it's absolutely true. We wanted the escape to be very loud and visceral and in a cacophony of sound and action and guns and everything else. One, because it puts you back in your seat a bit and you go, this is, you're setting the world and the violence of this world. And two, I think it sets up Frank Hamer nicely by the river when he's, you know, introduced to us. He's a guy who likes quiet. He's unnerved by honking horns on the bridge. He wants everything to settle down, and he wants it to be like 100 years ago, for better or worse. But yeah, no, absolutely. And John Johnson, our sound designer, is always done every movie. Very, very, very aware of that. And also when to have no sound. And also when you work with somebody as talented as Thomas Newman, who does the score, he's really, really aware of, let's do nothing here. You know, I wrote something, but I think we should strip it out. Or let's just do a tone here that you feel but don't hear.
Well, you were telling me a great story because we were talking about the movie playing South by Southwest, having its premiere there. And you were telling me a story about it because I asked you if it was going to play the Paramount. You had a great story to tell about Bonnie and Clyde playing the Paramount.
Yes. In 1967, when Arthur Penn's movie came out, it played in Austin at the Paramount Theater. And Frank Hamer was long dead. But Gladys Hamer, his Spitfire wife, went to see the movie. And in the movie, I mean, it's not supposed to be a historical movie. I mean, it's an anti-establishment movie. It's a Vietnam era movie. It opened the door for a lot of my favorite films, and I really love the movie. My significant other is not in the movie, though. And so Gladys, when she saw that they had made Frank Hamer a buffoon,
a joke. He's really a joke.
He's a joke. And it was a cop in Commerce, Oklahoma, that they just said, well, let's just make him Frank Hamer too, because that'll really give Frank Hamer a reason to want to kill these lovebirds. And, you know, and it's a cheap device and all that. And I'm sure that Robert Benton would admit to the same. And it's like, well, I just combined two characters. I wish I hadn't done that, you know. And so she got out of the screening and went and called Joe Jamail, who was a famous plaintiff's attorney in Texas, and said, we're suing Warner Brothers. And so a lawsuit was filed, and probably Warner Brothers was going to win because Frank Hamer was a public figure and it was going to be a hard case to win. But there was no winning. And Warner Brothers said, we did the wrong thing. Pay the lady. So they settled.
What a great way to end the show. My guest, who's a former lawyer himself, but now much better off as a writer-director, is John Lee Hancock. His terrific new film, which is on Netflix, and please go see it in the theater if you can, is The Highwayman. I can't thank you enough, John. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Newell. The show is mixed by Kat Yorks, edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I have no myth whatsoever. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.